From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
The Sinn Féin leader, she sort of was speaking with all the passion of someone ordering a sandwich when they're not hungry. Do you know that sort of way?
And the surgeon said, look, you do realise that when we get in there, we may have to do an awful lot more.
We have to make sure that every child gets to enjoy sports day. It should be fun for everybody.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, Oliver Callan editorialises on the elections, one man's harrowing medical experience, and how school sports days bring out the best and the worst in us. That's all on the way over the next hour of the Radio Catch-Up Show that was cheated out of that Egg and Spoon gold medal. And I know that you know Ricky. Let's begin the show today with Oliver Callan rhapsodising about the terrific performances of Irish athletes at the European Championships.
After the amazing success that seems to be rolling on for us in Rome, you remember last year, an American magazine famously labelled the Hot Irish Guy Summer, with all the success of our actors and stars of stage and screen. So 2024 might be about the Hot-Footed Irish Girl Summer, because it's our best European Athletics Championships ever, with the women at the front of it all. Our first medals in the European Championships since Sonia O'Sullivan back in 1998. We had the mixed relay golds, of course, hugely exciting at the weekend. Then Ciara McGeehan winning gold yesterday in the 1500 metres final, and immediately crediting her rampaging finish to her training on ending camogie matches with a purple patch. So that's a GAA go that we can finally get behind. Well done, Ciara McGeehan, of course, from Portaferry in lovely County Down, which is across the loch on the ferry from Strangford Loch, of course. And Rashida Adeleke, of course, the Tala youngster, is such a hot-toed Olympics contender that even she was disappointed with her stunning silver medal finish in the final last night. She was talking to David Gillick afterwards, and she's great crack. The good thing about these athletes, particularly Ciara and Rashida, is that they just have a bit of fun about them. They're sometimes sports people, you know, they're just we sported well, and we're looking forward to sporting well the next time. There's a bit of character, a bit of colour, and a bit of personality. This is Adeleke talking to David Gillick last night after the race, and what really kind of got her over the line.
When I crossed the line and I realised I came second, I was a bit devastated. I really wanted it, but as my coach said, we've been training through this competition, so to even come out here on a PB, 49.0, I'm really excited for this. This is my first 400 metre competition of the year as well, so I'm really excited. I wanted to make sure I was always in contention and never let them get too far ahead. I know around 200, there was a bigger gap than I liked, so I started to move, maybe a bit too early, maybe I should have waited a little bit.
Absolutely, and I just have to say that the home straight was obviously a massive fight. You know, again, what was going through your head?
I was like, don't die, please don't. I was like, legs, please don't give up on me.
The legs kept going anyway, they carried across the finish, so silver medal. And that's going to be a big contest in the Paris Olympics, so it's hugely exciting.
Exciting is the word. And it's a word that could possibly be applied to the elections, could it not? Well, maybe if you're one of the big parties.
Some mutterings for you on the election. Loads of photos I've been watching of smiling Fine Gaelers and joyful Fianna Fáilers. Giddy is how it's been described in some of the coverage. Micheál Martin and Simon Harris, they're going about the place. They kind of look respectively like the over-delighted senior and junior second place finishers of a regional pitch and putt competition. Because like when you look at it, the only thing that the two big parties, now that we're calling them after the locals, the only thing they've won is sort of excitable, gushing press coverage, because mainstream politics, it seems to be so smashed to bits that if you finish with 23%, which is less than a quarter of the vote, in a turnout of less than half the electorate, and you lose 30 or 40 council seats, that's deemed a win. So they're smiling away like mad. The biggest losers, no doubt, Sinn Féin, Mary Lou McDonald, what has gone on there? And I would say the opinion poll companies. Somebody texted me there before the election, said, what's the thing we should be looking out for in these elections? I said, just how badly wrong polling companies will get another result. And why should we continue to give coverage to them? Because, you know, particularly polls that are done by text and online, they seem to be rubbish. They flunked the general election 2020. They flunked the two referendums that we just had there a few months ago. And they have fallen totally asunder in the local elections vote, like a Sinn Féin canvassing team crashing into a 2FM lineup on the floor The polls are garbage. Wrong by 11 points on Sinn Féin's vote. Wrong by 6 to 7 points on Fianna Fáil's vote. Wrong on Labour. Wrong on the Social Democrats. Fine Gael's poll figure actually matches their dismal result. So it's kind of weird that they're claiming victory. But there you go. Opinion polls, I think, they're dead. People are either lying, they're just too wise to them, or maybe it's just expensive to do reliable face-to-face conversations, and particularly because it's traditional media that pay for all these opinion polls that you're relying on. And in this election, there was some very good analysis on RTE.ie in terms of the advertising spend, which went on social media. Crumbs for the mainstream media. So that tells its own story about where the money is to afford these things. The hero of the elections, Leo Varadkar. Take a bow. He realised some months ago he was so unpopular that simply by just slumping out of office, Fine Gael got the boost. So Simon Harris is being celebrated. Yes, he certainly has great energy. In fact, he doesn't stand still, does he? He doesn't stand for anything because he never stops talking or running about long enough to provide his actual plans for anything he's planning to do. And I'm important, I must go. And so I don't know, did the TikTok Taoiseach actually do any sit-down interviews? I certainly can't find it. He didn't seem to have done any of them at all. I don't believe he did. Maybe he heard Mary Lou McDonald doing that interview, come to the second, and said, that's not a good idea. In fact, I read one column yesterday that said Harris is a Taoiseach of action because he got the fences erected on the Grand Canal in Dublin. Is the bar now so low that sort of knee-jerk, paddy-whack moves like caging off the canal so you can push 50 tents downstream is a symbol of action? But maybe it is. This is, after all, a country that pauses the glacially slow counting of votes to watch a hurling match. And we don't count any votes before 9 o'clock in the morning. We're gas altogether. I'm sure you have to have the cup of tea and a chat before the democracy, don't you? Don't you, Gervais? Yes, you do. 49% is the turnout in the local elections. That means about 13, maybe 14, 15% of voters who will show up at the general election didn't say anything in these ones. So I assume they're angry people. So where will that 13, 15% anger go? Sinn Féin will try talking to them, but they're not sure what to say or whether they mean anything that they say. Mary Lou McDonald on Clare Byrne, whoo! She sounded on Clare Byrne like she was kind of irritated. Someone had interrupted her in the middle of watching Bridgerton and she had to talk about policies and things she'd really no interest in. Clare Byrne actually had to help Mary Lou to point out that the €300,000 Dublin house thing isn't going to apply to all the houses in Dublin, just the ones in the scheme. It took Clare Byrne to make that clear. And talk about energy. I mean, no energy. The Sinn Féin leader, she sort of was speaking with all the passion of someone ordering a sandwich when they're not hungry. Do you know that sort of way? It's like, it's just somebody make me Taoiseach. Oh, you're not going to happen. I might as well just, you know, I'll just sit over here for a bit. There was a great story I read that Fianna Fáil canvassers actually found a Sinn Féin candidate at home watching telly in Cork on the few days before the vote. So there you go. So forget the Republican Party. This is the armchair party. The opinion polls, just don't forget, they had them at 23% 5 days before the election. They finish below 12%. So there you go. All those polls showing the Sinn power up in the 30s were rubbish. Bertie Ahern, actually, is the only person I heard saying that out loud. After all, he used to say things like, 0% of nothing is still nothing. Do you know, that's the sort of, there'd be the good epithets, did they be doing the epithets. Get your epithets out. But I think in summary, someone said this to me, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, they kind of benefited from the traditional vote who, fearing the rise of the far right, the paddy fascists, you know, the carvery races who think garlic is too spicy, too foreign for them. Because remember, the far right, they don't actually get into power. They just change the conversation. I mean, the UKIP never got into power. The Tory party in Britain are now the far right. And Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, who are all the one thing now, let's face it, and they're all delighted transferring to each other. They sound like left-wing parties back after the Ukraine war and welcoming immigrants. And in 2021, in government, they plan to end direct provision. We're going to give homes to asylum seekers after 4 months and the right to work after 6. All gone. Instead, now they're talking about slashing welfare, removing safe countries of origin, using third-party countries and so on. It's all sounding a little bit Farage-Rishi Sunak. So the centre is not holding. The centre is turning right. It's not far right. It's a bit further right. You know, it's kind of, I can hear Pascal maybe explaining the Orwellian lurch that, you know, we're not the far right. We are the far middle. We are the in-betweeners, minus all the jokes about women's wobbly bits. Thank you very much.
No, thank you, Minister. That's some of Oliver's take on the local and European elections. An editorial on the state of the nation to kick off this morning's Oliver Callan and indeed today's Playback Daily. While we wait to see if the UN's ceasefire resolution will finally pause the war in Gaza, Claire Byrne spoke to Médecins Sans Frontières' Dr. Chris Hook, medical team leader in Gaza, about the situation in Al-Aqsa and Nasser hospitals as they treat a large amount of people with serious injuries following Israeli airstrikes.
I think in the early afternoon, we started to hear of some attacks in the middle area around Deir al-Balah in Gaza. And I was in Khan Yunis in Nasser Hospital, and we started to realise that there was probably going to be quite a lot of injured patients, and that knowing that the situation at Al-Aqsa was already bad, they were already overwhelmed. The hospital team there realised, you know, that the patients were going to be having to arrive further south. So they made plans and started evacuating as many sort of patients from the emergency department as they could safely do, patients that could possibly wait for care. And then we just kept an eye on the news waiting to hear what was happening. And from about 4 p.m. onwards, there was just a constant, steady flow of truly badly injured patients. In Nasser, we didn't receive any sort of the mild, you know, mildly injured cases, because they obviously sort of realized that there was, you know, the hospitals were overwhelmed and went home or stayed somewhere else in order to get care later. So in Nasser, we received, I think in the end, by between 4 p.m. And about 1 a.m., just over 70, between 70 and 75 genuinely badly injured patients, people with multiple devastating injuries to their limbs. We had a lot of unconscious people with bad head injuries who had to travel, you know, hours since their injury. It had taken for people to find them and be able to negotiate their way safely away from Deir al-Balah down to Nasser. So the hospital immediately, you know, becomes a very difficult place to work. There's all these patients arriving. They need such great level of care. By the end of the evening, by 1 o'clock in the morning, we were no longer able to sort of intubate and ventilate the patients that needed intensive care, because the intensive care was full. So we're having to manage these unconscious patients just with simple measures in the emergency department whilst we wait for patients to have their operations and see if they can wake up after them in order to get an intensive care space. So,
Chris, what is that like as a medical team leader? I mean, I know you make difficult decisions no matter where you're working, but if you are unable to treat patients in the way that you would want to, or in the way that you know that you should, what does that feel like?
I mean, it's obviously devastating. The Palestinian medics there have been having to make these pragmatic decisions obviously now for 8 or 9 months, and you know, it's still, you can see the difficulty and the anguish about doing this, and, you know, arguments within the team about, can we push the resources further? Can we do more for this individual patient? How can we do this? Where can we move more patients to? Where can we find more ventilators? It's a constant battle in that situation to try to push the resources you've got to the absolute limit for everyone. And at some point, it's just nothing more. And you know, it's heartbreaking to see that the teams there, you know, that we're a part of, having to make these decisions. It's you want to do your very best for each patient that comes through, but you know that you've got to try and do the best you can for as many as possible, and that's where it becomes, you know, really, really, really difficult and sad.
Mm-hmm. I know you were dealing with several unconscious children who came through as well. Are those cases prioritised if you can?
Yeah, for sure. Like, I mean, obviously anybody unconscious is immediately of the highest priority. But the problems come when, you know, there's 20 or 30 of those people all at the same, in the same sort of category, and you know the resources are limited. And then it's a case of trying to sort of tell whether who has the best chance of survival. And it's made more difficult by the fact that the hospital with the bed space and the capacity, like Nasser, doesn't have a functioning CT scanner anymore. So the patients arrive there, they get triaged, they get their initial treatment, but then we have to send them off to another hospital again to get a CT scan before we can truly know which patients have the best chance of survival. So it's this constant process of these patients having to suffer journeys where they're at great risk of further deterioration all around the Gaza Strip in order to get just the diagnostics they need for us to be able to understand who is most likely to survive and be able to make those decisions. So obviously children coming in unconscious is a very much more emotive situation, but it's still trying to apply those decisions sensibly and safely that will allow the most good to occur for the most people.
Chris, you, I know, have been in and out of Gaza over the last couple of months. And back in January, you said that one of the situations you faced was the most brutal experiences of your medical career. I can only assume it is becoming much worse as time goes on.
I mean, when I left Gaza in December, the situation was that we were receiving, Al-Aqsa Hospital and Nasser Hospital were receiving regular mass casualties and you know, severely injured, badly injured patients in numbers that they could not cope with. And when I left, I thought to myself, well, at least when I come back, the situation will definitely be better. And I find myself back there now, six months later, and the situation is exactly the same, if not worse, where those two hospitals, Al-Aqsa and Nasser Hospital, are being overwhelmed again by badly injured patients. But the external circumstances are even worse, where the people are living in dire conditions, even those that are well. So the hospital system, the healthcare system, is under a great pressure from just general health issues related to living in tents with no access to water, limited access to food, inability to get regular vaccines, inability to get good access to good level healthcare. So, you know, like I say, it feels like I'm you know, back in the same situation as we were in 6 months ago, in the same hospitals, doing the same work, and yet somehow, it is, the situation is even tougher for the people there.
And is your plan to go back in?
I hope so later in the year to go back. I mean, the needs in Gaza now will be immense for many, many years to come. And certainly with MSF, we have an absolute desire to support the population as much as we can, and we'll be there for the long term. So, you know, those needs are not going to go away for many, many, many years. And so, yes, I hope I can be a part of that ongoing care.
Dr. Chris Hook, Médecins Sans Frontières medical team leader in Gaza, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the grim situation there. It's the day that some dread and some look forward to, and it's nearly upon us as school sports days start happening all around the country. Catherine Thomas, sitting in for Ray Darcy, spoke this afternoon to Irish Times journalist Jen Hogan about the annual event that occasionally divides children and their parents.
What was your experience with sports day?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I love sport. I really love sport. I love competitive sport, and I've always enjoyed sport and wanted to be better at it. But sports day, for me, I still remember the stress, the absolute stress and fear of letting my parents down. That was always this thing. If they were there, that I would embarrass them. You know the way the minds of children can work. But I was really good at the three-legged race. This was my thing. This saved my embarrassment and shame, I think, on more than one occasion. But I do know, I remember those conversations when I was growing up, and I remember the conversations in the classroom, and you were paying particular attention to the heats ahead of the finals. So not even the three-legged race, the normal straight sprint and those kind of more serious races. You would look to see who's in your heat and hope to God that it was the child who'd come last in your class, so that at least, at the very worst, you weren't
going
to come last.
Yeah,
that's how ruthless I think it was sometimes. It was just, as long as I'm not last, because everybody always remembers the child who came last, particularly the child who came last, because they never really lived it down. You know, there was kind of constant teasing and flagging, and I don't want him on my team, and I don't want her on my team, and an awful lot of that kind of thing that happened. And as I got older, I disliked sports. I think that little bit more maybe because lollipops and sweets weren't enough to drown out certain aspects of sports day. But I mean, like I said, I had the three-legged race. I always had the three-legged race while the athletes were zooming off and flying along sprint. And I realised, you know, that getting your stride and your stride timed perfectly with your partner gave you a real chance at winning a medal.
It was about technique, wasn't it? And
it
you're,
was.
You're the mom. Yeah. You're the mom of seven children, and I'm not gonna. I mean, some could be sporty, some could be not. Yeah. Like in many families, and we talk a lot, Jen, and I've spoken to you a lot about building resilience in children. Mm. Do you think that sports days are a way of helping do this or actually hindering it?
It really depends on the way that it's done. I mean, I think resilience is always a great argument used by people to justify overly competitive situations. So I think there's often a lot of confusion about how resilience works. Children being knocked down constantly or constantly feeling failures or constantly finding that things too difficult for them doesn't build resilience. Mm. You know, it's not born of these negative experiences. That's not how it works. It's something that you draw upon, often built on from having maybe feelings of self-worth in other aspects or in just accepting things for what they are. It's something that they draw on to kind of cope with difficult experiences, but they're not built by difficult experiences. Mm. And I would really like us to see a wider move. It's already happening in lots of schools, but a wider move to less competitive sports days. And it's not that I'm against competition or competitive sports, though within the children's setting, I'm kind of very vocal on this when it comes to extracurricular activities too. I very much think it should be about participation and inclusion over competition, because I would like to see a situation where we have more children involved in sport and playing sport for longer. Mm. And for that to happen, it needs to be fun. And school is a different situation even to those extracurricular activities, because school is for all and sports day needs to be for all too. So we need to cater for all children, for those who just aren't sporty, for those who may have gross motor difficulties, for those who may have additional needs or disabilities. We have to make sure that every child gets to enjoy sports day. It should be fun for everybody.
So how do you do that though? How do you cater for everybody? Because I suppose, like you're saying, it's important to give sporty children recognition that they might not get in the classroom. And then at the same time, you know, no child should have to have a bad experience of sport through that public humiliation or failure in front of their parents. It's a difficult one.
It is, but I'm just picking up on what you said there about the sporty children that they might not get in the classroom. Sometimes when we're talking about children about perhaps being, oh, maybe they're not good at maths or English or Irish, but they're great at sport, it doesn't necessarily translate that the child who struggles academically is brilliant on the sports pitch any more than it's translated that the child who's excellent academically struggles on the sports pitch. So for some kids, it's like the double whammy. They struggle in every aspect of their life. But the difference with sports day, it's much more public, like I said there. It's done sometimes in front of parents, in front of their peers. Your struggles within the classroom or your challenges or the difficulties that you might have around academic aspects even. Mm. I remember how to speak. Aspects even. That's often something that you can keep a little bit more private, that a child can kind of deal with themselves, not in front of a whole audience. I suppose the thing around sports day is it's about making sports fun for everyone, including the more athletic children, including those who love sports. And I often think it comes back to the parents here, because the children are typically okay. If I was to even draw my own experience, I have children who have all sorts of different abilities and all sorts of different interests even within sports. And generally children are okay with making sure that their friends are included and turning sports day into a fun day of sports. So it isn't that I'm going, okay, we'll all run the race and everybody who comes first, last, everybody gets the medal, because that means nothing to kids. They still see that very much for what it is. Mm. And children still are keeping score and they're still watching who does what. But it's about perhaps finding a different way to do it. And one way that we might be able to do that is if we move towards games and teams and
sporting, where
obviously the teacher, the school, pick the teams again, being very mindful that we don't go back to a situation that potentially humiliates a child where they're picked last, you know, because it all comes back to that competition again. But where you get this mixed ability team and where we have games and fun activities that actually accentuate, I suppose, and support children with their fundamental movement skills, because we know that's a major issue too. We know our children are struggling with fundamental movement skills and that a significant portion can't run properly, don't know how to throw a ball properly, don't know how to kick a ball. These are all brilliant opportunities to get our kids active and enjoying sports and hopefully staying involved in sports and maybe even feeling that sport is for them.
Journalist Jen Hogan wondering why we can't all just get along with each other when it comes to school sports days, with Catherine Thomas on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. Let's be careful out there, kids. A little Irish film was released 20 years ago this year. It was the feature directorial debut of Lenny Abrahamson, and it told the story of two drug addicts making their way through Dublin in search of a fix. Yes, I speak of Adam and Paul. And the writer and co-star of the film, Mark O'Halloran, joined Oliver Callan in studio this morning to talk about the movie and his co-star, the late Tom Murphy.
You know, I live in the city centre. And there's still young fellas in the local spar shop who go, "Oh my God, it's Adam and Paul."
That's incredible, isn't it?
It's so weird. And I, you know, to be recognised after 20 years for something that you made, yeah, it's lovely. It's really beautiful.
Also to look like you did 20 years ago.
Well, that's the thing.
It's the good actor's
hair. But also, no, there has to be said that I'm playing somebody who's addicted to heroin, who lives on the street in a very difficult life. So I must look absolutely wrecked,
yeah,
all the time.
Older than, yeah. So it's going to be shown as part of the upcoming Bloomsday Film Festival. We'll talk about that. And there's another short story film as well, An Encounter. But making the film and the idea that was in your head when you're writing it, I mean, what did you want to say? It was about, it's really such a Dublin film.
Yeah.
You're a Clare man.
I'm a Clare man. But I moved to Dublin when I was about 20. Mm. And I was amazed that you could see heroin addicts on the street. Like I thought, I was living up in Parnell Street in the city centre. And I thought that was really bizarre. Like I saw a thing where I saw a young fella falling over in slow motion in the traffic island on O'Connell Street with a cigarette in one between fingers of one hand and the tip of a hypodermic needle in the
thing.
And he fell over in slow motion. It took him about 2 minutes to fall to the ground, and I was like, this is bizarre. And it felt like as if there was a slow motion, there was all these boys and girls walking around in a kind of a slow motion, and then everyone else was, you know, rapidly going about their business, and they didn't see them. And I was like, I was amazed. So I used to keep these diaries of things, and I remember at one point, I remember looking out my window, and at the time, Irish films, there was lots of Irish films that were about the national question, so it was all about like what the Brits did to us was desperate, and I was kind of going like, well, you know, I'm on the dole, I'm trying to make myself a career in acting. I don't care what the Brits did. Well, you know.
I care about today.
I do care about today. And I looked out the window and I was going like, why doesn't somebody make a film like that? Like the street that I look out onto, which felt very alive and very vibrant and had lots of stories in it. And so that's kind of the germ of it.
Yeah.
And then I was lucky enough to get put together with Lenny Abrahamson, who is the very brilliant Lenny Abrahamson.
Yeah.
And the two of us, he had never made a feature film. I had never written. I remember himself and his producer, Johnny Spears. You know, I brought in these sample scenes and my idea for what Adam and Paul would be. And then they said, all right, we're going to commission you to write a script. And I remember leaving that day going like, I'm absolutely crazy. I don't know how to do this.
You've got
to
do it now.
I have no idea.
So the diaries had to come out.
The diaries have to come out. And I began to, I remember the first, I sat at my desk and I was going like, how do you write, how do you start a film? So I just started with my character glued to a mattress, you know, like I had no idea what I was doing. Absolutely no idea.
Which sets a very funny tone at the beginning.
Yeah.
And it's a delicate line, isn't it?
Well, it is a delicate line because you don't want to be making fun of people. Mm. But I believe that everybody's ridiculous. We're all absolutely ridiculous, stupid people. All of us. And so, you know, I believe we should laugh at ourselves. We should laugh at everybody else. But we should also care for people. So there was an idea of giving a dignity to people who were nameless in lots of ways. And there was a joke in the middle of it, like, it's called Adam Paul, but you never find out which one is Adam, which one is Paul.
And I'm sure you're Adam.
Well, now it says it in the credits.
Oh, does it? Okay.
But we laughed at the time because people would look at the credits and go like, who the hell is Mark O'Halloran and who the hell is Tom Murphy? Anyway, nobody knew who we were, so they wouldn't be able to figure out. And it was a kind of a joke about. I liked the idea of people leaving the film and struggling to name people that they would normally step over on the street. So that was it in its basic sense.
Yeah.
But I used to deliver these pages of dialogue that I'd written over to Lenny Abrahamson's house, and we'd sit around his kitchen table and we'd laugh or we'd have ideas about things, and then I'd go away and write more pages, and it all came together, and within a year we were making it, which was kind of bizarre. Like, you know, I wasn't in the film industry, you know what I mean?
Was it shot very quickly?
It was shot over a month. It was shot in November 2003, I suppose. Yeah. It was miraculous because it was a very bright month.
Yeah, but it was a lot of sunshine, but it's
absolutely freezing. Mm. So at the end, when a certain thing happens to my character, I have to lie on a beach for quite a long time.
And you can see the wind.
It was so cold. It took me about a month to get over the cold of that of lying down. But it was a very vibrant time. Making it was felt very. It was just one of those happy accidents that happen in life where you find yourself doing something really vital that you really love and that you really believe in. Because it doesn't always happen that you believe in something or that you have that same energy. And you know, we'd never talked, or, you know, Lenny and I had never talked about, like, what about the box office figures, or who are we going to show this film to? Or we had no sales agent, we had nothing. And it just kind of... It resonated with people when it came out in a kind of a way, and it had this amazing journey around the world, you know.
How did it do, can you remind us? Because it is 20 years.
Well, we did really surprisingly well at the box office in Ireland, but also within about a couple of weeks, I remember I met this young fella on Parnell Street, and he goes, "Oh, look, wait, let me show you." And he took out a DVD that had the name Adam across it, and it had been ripped off. So it was ripped off an awful lot.
It was already been pirated.
It was. Okay. It was been pirated. And I was kind of delighted with that. I was kind of going, well, you know, I don't mind as long as people get to see it. And people still watch it. I'm really, and people come up to me all the time, as I said, you know, and shout at me on the street, "I'm not wiping myself with a potato bag." and all of that.
And that is a perfect example of the delicate balance between something so incredibly grim, but there was a wee bit of humour there.
Yeah, well, like, we wanted to show, like, how difficult it was to live on the street and all of that. That idea that, you know, where do you go to the toilet? Yeah. Where do you find food? Where do you... Constantly being moved on and being hated and being spat on, basically, and all of those things. How do you deal with that and maintain a dignity within yourself? And there was a joke within it where Tom's character is afraid of the electric toilet on O'Connell Bridge, so he has to go and have a shite behind a dumpster, and then he doesn't have anything to wipe his arse with, and find a potato bag in which to do it. I mean, the corporate logo or whatever of potato must have been absolutely horrified.
Yeah. Like, I noticed actually quite a few logos appearing in the...
There were more innocent times.
They were, yes.
They weren't so vetted. But yeah, it was trying to... That idea of trying to find dignity and the ridiculousness of it all at the same time.
Mark O'Halloran, who played Adam or Paul in the movie Adam and Paul, which is 20 years old somehow, talking to Oliver Callum this morning. Well, as the Irish athletics team continues to be amazing at the European Championships in Rome, Claire Byrne spoke to the Irish Times' Ian O'Riordan about the women's 4x400m team who won their qualifier this morning.
As you said there, 12 hours more or less exactly since that thrilling 400m final last night, where Rashida Adeleke ran one of the fastest times of all time to win the silver medal behind the Polish woman, Natalia Kaczmarek. I mean, we were so excited by that race last night that we kind of thought it would take some time to come down. And then we come down to the stadium again this morning, and who else but Charlene Mosley comes out for the heats of the women's 400 metres. Now, she was in that final as well last night, don't forget. She ran a little bit below her best to finish eight, and you could tell she was a little bit disappointed.
Yeah.
But she gave herself every chance to see, look, if I'm recovered in this morning, I'd like to be back involved in the relay. And they were in the second semi-final, and they were fourth when she took over the baton, and only the top three were sure of going through. And I don't know how she does it, and I'm not exaggerating here. It was like a superpower run. She produced another 49.76 second split to move from fourth up to first, and lo and behold, Ireland are now back into the final as the fastest qualifier. The expectation now is that Rashida Adeleke will join that quartet for the final. You're allowed to make two swaps for the final, which will happen tomorrow night, as you mentioned there, at 8 o'clock. So whether Adeleke is there or not, my information is that she will. I think Ireland are certainly well positioned for another medal on the closing night.
And will you put that run that Charlene did there this morning in context for us? 49.76 in the last leg of a 4x400m, Ian.
Yeah, and that would be her fourth race of this week, because of course she was involved with the mixed relay last Friday night, which already seems like a lifetime ago. Then she would have run her 400m semi-final, where she ran a very quick time. And you could see last night she was very disappointed. She was one of those runners who possibly went out a little bit fast, and as I mentioned, we were also engrossed in the race between Adeleke and Kaczmarek coming down the home straight. We kind of didn't look at the clock too closely. It was only afterwards when you saw the 48.98 winning time and then Rashida's 49.07, which smashed her own Irish record of 40.20, which she set last year. These are the two fastest European times this century, to put that in context.
It's extraordinary.
And it would have won Rashida 5 of the last 6 Olympic gold medals. The only medal she wouldn't have won actually was Tokyo. Mm-hmm. Last time out, but the previous 5 Olympics were won slower than 49.07, to give you some idea of just what she's done and at age 21.
It was clear that Rashida was gutted last night in the post-race interview with David Gillick that, you know, she hadn't taken gold. Talk about putting pressure on yourself. But also what was clear was that her eyes are very firmly on the Olympics, and she talked about training the whole way through with an eye on what's coming down the track in July, which I suppose raises the hopes of a nation for what's might happen in Paris.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe initially there was a slight sense of disappointment there. But no, I think the more she reflected, like all of us on the night last night, and maybe there was a couple of later interviews when she realised, when she looked at the times, she's gone, OK, I've run a 49.07. And as you say, this is not even my peak goal. The big target is those Paris Olympics in just over a month's time now. So I think it's actually possibly maybe worked out for the best that she's got that extra bit of incentive and hunger now, as disappointing as it might have been not to have won gold. But as I say, go back to the performance of Kaczmarek. Like she's a seasoned runner. She's won silver here before. She's won silver in the world stage. And she thought this was her chance at the gold medal. So for it even come so close, I think it was a superb performance. And then, as I say, to come back with a possible another relay medal tomorrow night, that would be her third medal in total. I'm not getting ahead of myself here, but for her, which at age 21, I don't think there's too many 21-year-old athletes have won three European medals.
Now, our men's team in the 4x400 didn't do as well this morning, unfortunately. They won't be in the final, is that right?
Yeah, well, they were in the first semi-final, and it's only the top three to go through, plus the two fast non-qualifiers. They were sitting in that second spot after the first heat, but no, they were bumped out then in the second semi-final. But that's a young team as well. That's a really young team. There's a 17-year-old on that team. So, and you can tell that it's the old cliche that the performance of the relay teams overall, I think, are raising the performances. Like, there was no great expectation on that men's team, but I certainly think they're a coming team for 2 or 4 years down the time, something like that. And it's certainly a question as well now. Like, I think, as I say, my information is that Adeleke will run the final. But just to look at the list there from this morning, I have it here in front of me. The Dutch women only qualified in third, but they can bring in their superstar Femke Bol for the final as well. Plus the old Natalia Klaver from the Dutch team as well. So you have two more Dutch women to come back there. So it could be a repeat of the mixed relay final where Ireland and potentially Dutch could be battling it out for gold.
OK, so what we want to watch out for tonight is the 4x400, the women running at 5 past 8 our time. Ian, isn't that right?
Tomorrow night, Claire.
Oh, yes, tomorrow night. But tonight we have Laura Mooney running, don't we?
That's just a straight 10,000 metres final, yes. That's one of the last individual events, actually, for the Irish team. And then tomorrow night we also have Andrew Coskren in the men's 1500 metres final, which is going to be interesting, because there was 4 runners actually fell in the heats, but they were all reinstated on appeal. So I think there's going to be a 17-man final where you would normally have 12. That's going to be interesting. But no, the women's 400 metres tomorrow night. That's the final
tomorrow night,
session.
5 past 8. Okay. So that's another night where I can't get anybody to bed in my house because everybody's too excited having watched these things. But it's just, I mean, for you, I mean, you're watching this for years, and it's a hackneyed phrase to say this is unprecedented, but it really is for Irish athletics, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I've been lucky to go back to the championships since Sonia Sullivan's time in 1998. But the one thing I will say, Claire, like, this is not really unexpected. I mean, some people are saying, where has this come from? Is this why are we suddenly becoming a sort of a minor superpower in athletics? But no, this has been coming for a while. We won two medals 2 years ago in Munich when Ciarán McGeehan obviously won silver, and she stepped up to gold here. We all know the ability of someone like Adeleke, who's clearly taken that relay team to a new level as well. So I wouldn't say it's come out of nowhere. It's more a reflection, I suppose, maybe on delivering some of the potential that was there. Maybe in the past, there might be 1 or 2 athletes covering up the track.
The Irish Times' Ian O'Riordan talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the ongoing success of the Irish athletics team at this year's European Championships in Rome. Plenty more to come, I'd say, knowing as I do absolutely nothing about athletics. Peter spoke to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about his recent medical experience, which makes for difficult but, especially if you're a man, pretty vital listening.
I'm 67 years of age. Mm-hmm. I'm healthy, or I was healthy. I was fit. I'm not overweight. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life, and I drank the same as most Irish people, but funnily enough, gave it up more or less in the last couple of years.
Okay.
So life was good. I live with my lovely wife, who is my soulmate, and we live in Dalgety Village, which is magnificent. So life was good. I was beginning to wind down work-wise. I was taking one day off to play golf. Well, I won't say play golf, go around the golf course,
yeah,
which I was able to, I was fit enough to do. And like most men in Ireland, after the age of 50, I was always warned to go to your doctor to get checked out, to do an MOT every 6 months to a year, which I did. And I was only suffering from the usual bout of slightly enlarged prostate, which meant the odd extra trip to the bathroom. But that was being controlled by Tamsulosin, no problem. Slightly high blood pressure, which was controlled with amlodipine. So life was good. Everything was fine. Now, about a year ago, I noticed a little bit of blood in my urine. Not much, just the last few drops on the white porcelain. I said, golly, that looks a bit pink. So I examined it. Yes, a bit of blood.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. It's obviously some kind of urine, intestinal tract, some kind of disorder. It'll be some kind of virus or whatever. So I went to my local doctor, Connor Downs in Greystones, who, yes, he said, yes, you've got some kind of infection. So antibiotics, fine. Now, he did mention at the time that men tend not to get these kind of infections. It's more likely to be a woman gets that kind of infection, but not men. But he said, look, that should clear up. Everything should be fine, which it did. About 2 months ago, I noticed a bit of blood again. Now, I also had, the other symptom I had was, it sounds awful, but it really wasn't. I noticed a very slight discharge when I went for a pee, just sort of a bit of liquid. But really, it wasn't a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I could so easily have missed it. And the only other sign that there was something wrong was when I sat in my chair in the office, I got a very slight tingling sensation in my perineal area, right between my legs, and the urge to pee. So given that and given what he said, I said, look, I better hove off to Connor and let him have a look. So I did, and he gave me the checkup and he gave me the prostate exam. Not pleasant, but listen, has to be done. He checked the bloods and he said, yes, there's a bit of infection there. But he said, look, given what I said the last time, I think we better get you into a urologist, you see. So he mentioned Hubert Gallagher in the Beacon, and Hubert Gallagher was an ex-Greystones rugby club man. So I had a connection with him. So I said, yeah, it's great to have a connection. So I went in to see Hubert on the 16th of April, and he, very professional, gave me a bit more of a thorough examination. And he suggested that we had, and it made my blood run cold. He said, let's just put a camera down your penis and go down and have a look in your bladder and just have a look to be on the safe side.
Okay.
Now, I did blanch at that. The idea of it is horrifying.
Yeah.
But he said, no, he said, it's a very routine operation. It's not even an operation. It's a very routine procedure. It happens many, many times a week. It's 2 minutes of unpleasantness and then it's done. So I went in on the 19th of April. And God, I'll never forget it. With the jigs and the reels, it wasn't 2 minutes. It was 10 minutes of absolute nightmare. They couldn't get the camera in. When they got the camera in, it was so painful. I was roaring, screaming. Now, I did curse a little bit. I did apologize afterwards. But then he said, about 10 minutes into this, he said, look, I think you're right. I think maybe I'll bring you back in and put you to sleep for it. So that was like heaven. You know, I said, that's fantastic. Great, do it when I'm asleep. Back on the 25th of April, put me to sleep. Did the job, you see, fantastic. I woke up in hospital and he came in. He said, look, we did have a look. He said, I think I've seen something.
Okay.
Can't tell you what it is. It looks to be fairly small, but he said, I tried to take a biopsy, but as soon as I touched this thing, it sort of blood came out. And he wasn't sure whether he'd got enough for a biopsy. But we did an MRI, we did scans, and he sent me home with a catheter down to a bag on my leg, and which was okay. I mean, it's not pleasant, but it's okay. So I went home, and he said that the reason you have the catheter is because we were poking around, in case the tubes swell and block, and then you can't urinate. That could be a problem. So it was all very. He said, I'm sure, you know, sure everything's fine, but I'll send you home, and we wait for the results of the biopsy. So a few days later, he phoned and he said, look, he said, I've never seen this before. He said, I've never seen one of these before. So I think it's best if I refer you to the guy who's the top dog, Ivor Cullen. He said, he's the man who handles this type of thing. Now, I still didn't know what this type of thing was. So we went to see Ivor in the Blackrock Clinic on the 10th of May, and I brought my lovely wife, Nora, in with me. We went up to his office, sat down, Nora sitting beside me. She was confidently expecting something like a polyp or something we could get rid of with some kind of treatment. And I must confess, so was I. It was all sort of very light because the symptoms had been so slight. And Ivor said, look, tell me all about it. So I launched into my story, much as I've done with you. And then after 5 minutes, I said, well, hold on a second. This guy's the expert. He's got the results of the biopsy. Yeah. He's got the results of the MRI. And he knows more about this than I do. So I stopped and I said, Ivor, I said, tell me. I said, is this serious? And he looked at me and there was a slight pause. And I think he was sort of eyeing me up and down. And he decided I was the kind of guy who wanted it straight. I don't want sugarcoating. And he said, yes, this is extremely serious. Right. So I felt my wife stiffen beside me. And I said, okay. I said, is this survivable? And again, there was that slight pause. And then he said, I really don't know. And that's the moment where the little hairs went up in the back of my neck, you see. And I felt Nora starting to sob beside me. So he said, right. I said, is there anything you can do? And he said, yes, there is. He said, what we're going to do is we're going to get you into Beaumont as quickly as we can. You're on my urgent list. You're number six on the list.
Okay.
He said, this is a very rare tumor. It's cancer of the urethra. Now, there was a technical name for it, but essentially it is very rare. And he said, it's affected almost the entire urethra. He showed me the MRI scans. Okay. I mean, I'm looking at it. To me, this was just a big colourful thing. But he did explain, he said, look, what we'll try and do, we will operate, we will take out the urethra, which is the tube from the bladder to the end of the penis, basically. We'll remove the penis, we've no option, and we'll rejig the bladder so you can have a little tube coming out of your tummy, a suprapubic catheter, and you can have a little tap on that, you see. So I was thinking, well, I'm pragmatic. If that's what you've got to do, that's what you've got to do.
Okay.
So it happened very quickly. I saw him on the 10th of May. 20th of May, I'm into Beaumont. I'm admitted to Beaumont. I'm taken in and put on a trolley. I said goodbye to my wife. And they came in and the surgeon said, look, you do realise that when we get in there, we may have to do an awful lot more.
Okay.
We may have to take your prostate. We may have to take the bladder. We may have to take, like, everything. So, again, what can you say? Look, you'll know when you get in, do what you have to do. I woke up in my bed in Beaumont. And I must say, at this stage, the staff in Beaumont are magnificent. From the moment I was in to the moment I was out, cleaning staff, porters, cooks, doctors, nurse, fantastic. Can't fault them. So I was with them until the 29th of May. I do have a rather unpleasant looking wound on my lower abdomen, which I don't like looking at the moment, just because I don't like looking at it, right? I do have my suprapubic catheter, so I can pee through that. I went home. I feel fine. Except that I've got to get this wound changed. Now, I will be going in to see him in July. We don't know what the long-term prognosis is. Nobody does. But I think we'll come up with a plan, which will probably mean radio, chemo, whatever. But my point really is that these guys, when I went to see them, my symptoms were so slight. And they were bearable. They were getting worse so slowly and so slightly. I was very close to just ignoring it and just carrying on. I was living the life. I was enjoying myself. This was all bearable. This wasn't a drawback at all. And if I hadn't gone to see Conor Downes and through the chain of command up to Ivor Cullen, at this stage, I would have thought in a very short space of time when I eventually went in to see him and I'd asked the question, is there anything you can do? The answer would have been, I'm terribly sorry, there isn't.
A sobering tale told by Peter on this afternoon's Liveline. And Peter told it so well, and on the airwaves, because he especially wanted to raise awareness of something that happens to a number of men in Ireland every year. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, after years of steep interest rate rises, what does the future hold banking-wise? Well, the Banking and Payments Federation Ireland had its annual National Banking Conference today, and Claire Byrne spoke this morning to the CEO of the Banking and Payments Federation, Brian Hayes.
So we had that ECB rate cut, and analysts are suggesting that there will be two more this year. Will that mean cheaper mortgages for people?
Well, we're clearly in a new phase in the interest rate cycle. Obviously, the decision that was taken by the ECB last week is a welcome decision for the economy. Anytime where key monetary indicators from central banks are reducing rates, it's good for investment and it's good for general confidence levels within the economy. Their next meeting, as you know, is in July, and we'll have to wait and see what they do in terms of future projection. So we'll have to wait and see. But I suppose the immediate response is in terms of the tracker, those who are on tracker mortgages, which will be down by 0.5. And it should be also highlighted, Claire, that there's a technical readjustment that the ECB have made for tracker mortgage holders of another 0.35% in September. So tracker customers will see that effectively 0.6 of a reduction over the next number of months, and we'll wait and see what happens in other parts of the market.
But you're not saying that there will be lower interest rates on offer when it comes to variable and fixed rates?
Well, we're already beginning to see actually lower fixed rate products. That happened before the 25 basis point reduction by President Lagarde last week. I think that the industry more generally should be judged by its actions. I mean, over an 18-month period, as your listeners will know, Claire, the ECB rate went up by 4.5%, the biggest hike of core rates at any stage in the ECB's history. Yet over that period of time, for new mortgages, the increase on average across the Irish banking sector was 1.5%, the third lowest transmission of interest rates over that 18-month, 24-month period happened in the Irish market. So I think it happened for two reasons. One, there's still significant competition for new mortgages and for new products across the industry, and that's good because we need competition. But the other reason is that no one likes to hear. I think the sector, you know, at a bank-by-bank, non-bank-by-non-bank level, we're very conscious of the inflationary pressures that consumers and their customers are under. So they didn't pass through the rates.
Savers were disappointed that in some cases they weren't seeing the benefit of it either.
Well, there's 880,000 odd mortgage payers in the country. It's the biggest single payment every single month for most of those people. Between tracker rates, variable rates and fixed rates, the facts are that the third lowest pass-through of the ECB rate rise happened in the Irish market. And that's the facts. And you can dress it up or dress it down any way you like, but the truth is the sector, and especially Irish banks, were very conscious of the pressures that people were under. Now, you might say, on the other side, we certainly it looks like we're slightly behind where the EU average is, but in the last number of months, that's come up quite a bit. And you could argue, you know, what 90% of the savers, 90% of the savings are owned by 10% of the public. You know, I think banks took a very fair and balanced view over the past 2 years in that very difficult inflationary environment to be aware of where their customers are and the evidence supports that.
So the savers really are not going to, there's not enough of them really, they don't represent enough of your customer base to pass that on, whereas the mortgage people, you need to hold on and look after them. Is that the message that you want to send?
No. There's a balanced approach that banks have to take to this, because they also want people to keep deposits, because, you know, a great deal of mortgages in the retail banking sector today are written through deposits. So they're very keen to keep savers and depositors. It's the other side of the balance sheet. But what I'm saying is that, you know, there's a fairness and approach that has to be deployed here on both sides of the balance sheet.
All right.
And in other markets, the full extent, are close to the full extent of the ECB rate rise happened. It didn't happen in Ireland.
Listen, Brian, how did you feel about the Taoiseach Simon Harris wagging the finger at your members about passing on the interest rate reduction to your customers?
Well, the Taoiseach is entitled to speak to anyone he likes, Claire, and he's entitled to say what he likes. But I'm also aware that he's aware of the facts, and I've just said them to you and to your listeners. You know, this isn't 2008, 2009. The banking industry is in a totally different position. It's been very well managed. in the past number of decades. We've moved to a totally new position, a more consolidated position, because other international retail players have left the market.
Well, he doesn't feel that way. If he thinks he has to come out and say publicly that, you know, you need to be told, your members need to be told to pass this on.
Well, what I'd say is this. I mean, the Minister of Finance speaking at our conference this morning, and he repeated a message he said last week. He highlighted the fact that price decisions are commercial decisions for individual entities. You know, those pricing decisions, banks are legally prohibited under competition law by having some kind of public signalling to anyone, be they politicians, journalists, or even industry bodies like ourselves. Mm-hmm. So he was making the point that these are commercial decisions. But he also said, and he repeated it again this morning, that he wants the benefits to be passed on. We heard that message loud and clear. And the minister said this morning that he asked lenders to treat people in a fair way. And
question to you is, do your members need to be told that? And I do understand that Michael McGrath was more nuanced in his message. I heard him on the news at one once Simon Harris had made that call. But do you get offended by politicians like Simon Harris wagging the finger at you, as I say, and telling you to pass these benefits on?
Listen, Claire, I don't get offended by lots of things, and certainly politicians and the government is a key stakeholder for the banking industry. We do a lot together. First Home Scheme, for instance, half the equity came from the Irish banks. You saw what we did during the COVID pandemic. You saw what we did when it came to the transition of over 2 million accounts when the banks were leaving. We work very closely with government as a key stakeholder. The government is more than entitled to set out its view. It's more than entitled to meet different industry figures. And communication is both ways. And we want to hear what they have to say. And I suspect they want to hear what we have to say.
That's Banking and Payments Federation CEO Brian Hayes talking all things banking with Claire Byrne this morning. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. Until the next time, from me, thanks for listening and good luck.